Protestantism in Scotland. Chapter 10. The Last Days of Queen Mary and John Knox. The dangerous crisis was now past, and a tide of prosperous events began to set in favor of the Scottish Reformation. The rising of the Earl of Henley, in the north, who, knowing the court to be secretly favorable, had unfurled the standard for Rome, was suppressed. The alienation which had parted Knox and Lord James Stuart, now Earl of Murray, for 2 years was healed. The Protestant spirit in the provinces was strengthened by the preaching tours undertaken by the reformer. The jealousies between the court and the church, though not removed, were abetted. The abdication of the queen, which grew out of the deplorable occurrences that followed her marriage with Darnley, and to which our attention must briefly be given, seeing they were amongst the most powerful of the causes which turned the balance between Protestantism and Romanism, not in Scotland only, but over Europe, and, as a consequence of her abdication, the appointment, as regent of the kingdom, of the Earl of Murray, the intimate friend of Knox, and the great outstanding patriot and reformer among the Scottish nobles, all tended in one direction, to the establishment, namely, of the Scottish Reformation. Accordingly, in 1567, the infant James being king, and Murray regent, the Parliament which met on the 15th of December ratified all the acts that had been passed in 1560, abolishing the papal jurisdiction, and accepting the Protestant faith as the religion of the nation. Valid legal securities were thus for the first time reared around the Protestant Church of Scotland. It was further enacted that no prince should afterwards be admitted to the exercise of authority in the kingdom without taking an oath to maintain the Protestant religion, and that none but Protestants should be admitted to any office, with the exception of those that were hereditary or held for life. The ecclesiastical jurisdiction, exercised by the assemblies of the church, was formally ratified, and commissioners appointed to define more exactly the causes which came within the sphere of their judgment. The Scottish Reformation had now reached its culmination in that century, and from this point Knox could look back over the battles he had waged, and the toils he had borne, and contemplate with thankfulness their issue in the overthrow of the papal tyranny, and the establishment of a scriptural faith in Scotland. He had, too, received legal guarantees from the state that the abolished jurisdiction would not be restored, and that the Protestant Church would have liberty and protection given it in the exercise of its worship and the administration of its discipline. The 2 years that followed, 1568 and 1569, were perhaps the happiest in the reformer's life, and the most prosperous in the history of his country during that century. Under the energetic and patriotic administration of the good regent, Scotland enjoyed quiet. The Reformed Church was enlarging her borders. All was going well, and that yearning for rest which often visits the breasts of those who have been long tossed by tempests began to be felt by Knox. He remembered the quiet years at Geneva, the loving flock to whom he had there ministered the word of life, and he expressed a wish to return thither and spend the evening of his life, and lay his wearied body, it might be, by the side of greater dust in the Plainpalais. But it was not to be so. Other storms were to roll over him and over his beloved church before he should descend into his grave. The assassination of the regent Murray, in January, 1570, was the forerunner of these evils. The tidings of his death occasioned to Knox the most poignant anguish, but great as was his own loss, he regarded it as nothing in comparison with the calamity which had befallen the country in the murder of this great patriot and able administrator. Under the Earl of Lennox, who succeeded Murray as regent, the former confusions returned, and they continued under Mar, by whom Lennox was succeeded. The nobles were divided into two factions, one in favor of Mary, while the other supported the cause of the young king. In the midst of these contentions, the life of the reformer came to be in so great danger that it was thought advisable that he should remove from Edinburgh, and take up his residence for some time at St. Andrews. Here he often preached, and though so feeble that he had to be lifted up into the pulpit, before the sermon had ended his earnestness and vehemence were such that, in the words of an eyewitness, he was like to ding the pulpit in blads and fly out of it. Weary of the world, and longing to depart, he had nevertheless to wage battle to the very close of his life. His last years were occupied in opposing the introduction into the Presbyterian Church of an order of bishop known only to Scotland, and termed Tulchin. Several rich benefices had become vacant by the death of the incumbents, and other causes, and the nobles, coveting these rich living, entered into simoniacal bargains with the least worthy of the ministers, to the effect that they should fill the posts, but that the patrons should receive the richest portion of the income, hence the term Tolchin bishops. Knox strongly objected to the institution of the new order of ecclesiastics first, because he held it a robbery of the church's patrimony, and secondly, because it was an invasion on the Presbyterian equality which had been settled in the Scottish Kirk. His opposition delayed the completion of this disgraceful arrangement, which was not carried through till the year in which he died. In August 1572, he returned to Edinburgh, and soon thereafter received the news of the St. Bartholomew massacre. We need not say how deeply he was affected by a crime that drowned France in Protestant blood, including that of many of his own personal friends. Kindling into prophet-like fire, he foretold from the pulpit of St. Giles's a future of revolutions as awaiting the royal house and throne of France, and his words, verily, have not fallen to the ground. His last appearance in public was on the 9th of November 1572, when he preached in the Tolbooth Church on occasion of the installation of Mr. Lawson as his colleague and successor. At the close of the service, as if he felt that no more should flock see their pastor, or pastor address his flock, he protested, in the presence of him to whom he expected soon to give an account, that he had walked among them with a good conscience, preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ in all sincerity, and he exhorted and charged them to adhere steadfastly to the faith which they had professed. The services at an end, he descended the pulpit stairs, with exhausted yet cheerful look, and walked slowly down the high street leaning on the arm of his servant, Richard Bannatyne, his congregation lining the way, reverently anxious to have their last look of their beloved pastor. He entered his house never again to pass over its threshold, was meet he should now depart, for the shadows were falling thickly, not around himself only, but around Christendom. While the events we have so rapidly narrated were in progress, Mary Stuart, the other great figure of the time, was pursuing her career, and it is necessary that we should follow not in their detail, for that is not necessary for our object, but in their outline and issue a series of events of which she was the center, and which were acting with marked and lasting effect on both Romanism and Protestantism. We have repeatedly referred to the League of the Three Papal Powers, France, Spain, and Rome, to quench the new light which was then dawning on the nations, and bring back the night on the face of all the earth. We have also said that of this plot Mary Stuart had become the center, seeing the part assigned her was essential to its success. It is surely a most instructive fact that the series of frightful crimes into which this prince has plunged was one of the main instrumentaries that Providence employed to bring this plot to naught. From the day that Mary Stuart put her hand to this bond of blood, the tide in her fortunes turned, and all things went against her. First came her sudden and ill-starred affection for Lord Darnley, the son of the Earl of Lennox. Then followed her marriage with him, accomplished through treachery, and followed by civil war. The passion which Mary felt for Darnley, a weak, vain, and frivolous youth, and addicted to low company, soon gave place to disgust. Treated with neglect by her husband, Mary was thrown upon others, and then came her worse than unseemly intimacy with the low-born and low-bred Italian, David Rizzio. This awakened a fierce and revengeful jealousy in the breast of Darnley, which led to the midnight assassination in the palace. A band of visored barons, with naked swords, suddenly appeared in the supper chamber of the queen, and seizing her favorite, and loosening his grasp on the dress of his mistress, which he had clutched in despair, they dragged him out, and dispatched him in the antechamber, his screams ringing in the ears of the queen, who was held back by force from rescuing him. Then came the settled purpose of revenge in the heart of Mary Stuart against her husband, for his share in the murder of Rizzio. This purpose, concealed for a time under an affectation of tender love, the more effectually to lure the vain and confiding Lord Darnley into the snare she had set for him, was steadily and coolly pursued, till at last it was consummated in the horrible tragedy of the Kirk of Field. The lurid blaze which lighted the sky of Edinburgh that night, and the shock that roused its sleeping citizens from their beds, bring upon the stage new actors, and pave the way for outrages that startle the imagination and stupefy the moral sense. Darnley has disappeared, and now an infamous and bloody man starts up by the side of Mary Stuart. There comes next her strange passion for Bothwell, a man without a single spark of chivalry or honor in him, coarse-minded, domineering, with an evil renown hanging about him for deeds of violence and blood, and whose gross features and badly molded limbs did not furnish Mary with the poor apology of manly beauty for the almost insane passion for him to which she abandoned herself. Then, before the blood of her husband was dry, and the ruins of the Kirkcaldy field had ceased to smoke, came her marriage with Bothwell, whom the nation held to be the chief perpetrator of the cruel murder of her former husband. To take in marriage that hand which had spilt her husband's blood was to confess an act what even she dared not confess in words. From this moment her fatuous career becomes more reckless, and she rushes onward with awful speed towards the goal. Aghast at such a career, and humiliated by being ruled over by such a sovereign, her subjects broke out in insurrection. The queen flew to arms. She was defeated on the field of Carberry Hill and brought as a captive to Edinburgh, then sent to Lochleven Castle, where she endured a lonely imprisonment of some months. Escaping thence, she fled on horseback all night long, and at morning presented herself at the castle gates of the Hamiltons. Here she rallied round her the supporters whom her defeat had scattered, and for the last time tried the fortune of arms against her subjects on the field of Langside, near Glasgow. The battle went against her, and she fled a second time, riding night and day across country towards the border, where, fording the Solway, she bade adieu to Scottish soil, never more to return. She had left her country behind, not her evil genius, nor her ill fortune. These, as a terrible nemesis, accompany her into England. There, continuing to be the principal card in the game the Popish powers were playing, she was drawn to conspire against the life and throne of Elizabeth. It was now that doom overtook her. On a dull winter morning, on the 8th of February, she who had dazzled all eyes by her beauty, all imaginations by her liveliness and gaiety, and who had won so many hearts by her fascinating address, the daughter of a king, the wife of a king, and the mother of a king, and who herself had sat on two thrones, laid her head, now discrowned, gray with sorrows, and stained with crimes, upon the block. At the very time that the Armada was being built in the dockyards of Spain, and an immense host was being collected in the Netherlands, with the view of making vacant Elizabeth's throne, and elevating Mary Stuart to it, the head of the latter princess fell on the scaffold.